admit it. I admit it. I didn't actually go to Japan.
What?
I had the plane ticket and everything, and I chickened out, and I spent the whole week in a library reading about Japan so that you guys wouldn't think I was weird.
The Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast has never posted Drake lyrics as a caption.
Welcome to episode 67 of the Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast. I'm your host, Sock Jig. You can follow me on Twitter at Sock Jig and on Instagram as well. I'm in San Francisco right now and I'm finishing and editing the podcast here in a hotel. I realize I didn't record an intro for this episode, so I'm here doing it on my AirPods. So I apologize for the shitty audio sound, but it's only for this beginning intro. Some of the topics I have today, I talk about the Bodhi Astrograbber shoe and the release that they had. I talk about my old friend Hidden New York and his ASICs. I talk about Nike's relationship with GOAT when it comes to releasing PE pairs with the University of Oregon Duck sneakers. I talk about Nike's current marketing problem and Nike's current shitty products problem. Those AI sneakers they debuted in France, as well as the shitty MLB gear that they're making with Fanatics. And in the course of doing this segment, the solution of this problem just became clear that they gotta fire their CEO. So I talk a little bit about that. But most of the rest of the episode, I talk about a trip that I went on to Japan. The cold open is from an episode of News Radio where Andy Dick's character comes back from Japan and can't stop talking about it. But eventually he, you know, confesses that he didn't actually go to Japan. He chickened out, but I did go to Japan. I talk about my planning and how Instagram and TikTok are almost like a key part of vacation planning now. I talk about the clothing and sneakers I wore and what the Japanese people were wearing and what shopping was like. And also give a sidebar on the history of Japanese fashion and how it started in Ginza. So this whole Japan travel log bit might not be for you, so feel free to skip it. But if you've been thinking of going or planning on going and you want to hear my thoughts, maybe it'll be helpful for you. Some of the topics I'm not talking about this week, I'm not going to be talking about Drake or Kendrick and diss tracks and stuff like that. I don't know, 38-year-olds talking about diss tracks genuinely and not as a joke, it's just cringe to me, so not going to be hearing me talking about it. And I'm also not going to be talking about the Caitlin Clark getting a signature shoe and how Asia Wilson may have been overlooked. But I have seen some women's college basketball in the Final Four especially, and because I'm a man and I've seen a few games, I'm a bit of an expert now, so not really. But what I'm saying is I will cover the state of signature basketball sneakers in the State of Sneaker game episode that I do every year, and that'll be the next episode. But first, pickups, skips, and misses.
On feet lately, I've been wearing the Ice Studios Gel Keanu 14. And for pickups, I wasn't really buying a lot of stuff before my big Japan trip. You know, you kind of put things off as either I'll just get to it after the trip, and then, you know, you don't want stuff being delivered while you're gone. I was able to get the Kith 1906R from the Vitality Exclusive Access. That, I think, is one of the better versions of that silhouette. I've always criticized this silhouette before as looking like a hubcap, and it still kind of looks like a hubcaps, but the Kith palette works on this one. Also, while I was in Japan, I was able to get the Kith ASICS Gel Keanu 14 and the 1130 through Vitality Access as well, too. And that was cool. That was on Kith Canada, so it's cool that they're doing that up in Canada and in the US as well, too. They were easy to get in Canada. Maybe there's not that many people who have Vitality level yet in Canada. It was probably easy for me because living close to the border, I've been buying from the US and stuff, you know, for many years, so it just added up. And these are similar to the Scarab ones I think were released last year, but they are slightly different. The model numbers are different. I think there's a little bit more Kith branding on them. Also, while I was in Japan, I was able to get the Ducks of a Feather Air Max 1. And this is 100% due to my friend VNDSK. Shout out VNDSK, who just copped these for me and just assumed I wanted a pair. So thank you very much to him. You know, these dropped at like 1 a.m. Japan time, and he picked them up, and I guess he had early access or something. I don't know exactly what happened, but I will talk about GOAT and Nike's relationship in a segment later. Also, stuff I picked up in Japan, I will talk about in the whole Japan segment as well, too. In terms of skips, I skipped out on the Jound Samba. This dropped also while I was in Japan, and I was online when it dropped, just on my phone, and you know, I saw the price, I saw with shipping and taxes and all that, and I was like, eh, it's too much, it's a nice shoe, I don't think I'd wear it enough to spend $275 US or whatever it came up to. I also skipped out on the Joe Fresh Goods 1000. I didn't enter the raffle, and this is nothing against Joe Fresh Goods or anything, I just, you know, when there's a new model out, I don't always jump to it right away. And I don't think I would wear the pink one very often. And the other one, the one that's inspired by the Airtuned Max Celery colorway, I already have the Airtuned Max. And so, you know, like I said earlier in previous episodes as well, I've been trying not to cop every single shoe that I think is nice. So it's a new model. I'm sure, you know, ALD and Kith and all the other collaborators will have their go at it as well this year. I'm not sure how it exactly fits. Some New Balance, I'm true to size, and some like the 2002R, I have to go up a full size or half a size. But the entire campaign was fire. The whole Get Money Boys video was really awesome. I did buy the Hot Boys jersey. Jerseys are kind of in, and you know, spring and summer are here, and so it'll be easy enough to wear. And as I was talking about that campaign, you know, I talk about it a little bit later in the Nike segment about how we expect good marketing from brands, we expect good marketing from Nike, and we applaud when we see good marketing, even with Adidas and Anthony Edwards, and same with Joe Fresh Goods. It's like, thank you for marketing it to us, and thank you for doing it right. In terms of misses, Air Max Day happened when I was in Japan. The Air Max Day, Air Max 1 Blue Volt 1, you know, it didn't really drop in any stores. It was only on sneakers. I have the first Volt Red Air Max 1 from when that dropped, you know, 10 years ago. So I tried for this one, but, you know, my sneakers app is basically flagged at this point. I can enter anything, but I'm never going to win anything. And here I have, you know, an IP address that's usually in Canada that is now in Japan and shipping to the US. Sneakers app is like, get out of here. So I entered for that, missed, moved on with my day. And then also missed out on the Jordan 4 Military Blue Shock Drop, same thing. You know, I'm not exactly pressed about how it's a darker shade of blue. It's a shoe that I kind of want, but if I copped, I probably wouldn't wear it. So these are the kind of good candidates where it's probably a good idea to skip. But then again, if it adds to cart, I'll probably cop. But the thing with shock drops and early drops is it's really nice to get it out of the way. So I definitely would have if I could have, but oh well, it gives me more time to reconsider, I guess. And, you know, I remember back in the day in Facebook days, like in 2014 or so, all the Facebook groups were basically full of people selling their 2012 version of these Military Blue because the quality was shitty. It had a Jumpman on the back. So just remember when people say you had to be there. No, you didn't always have to be there. More sneakers apps, I guess these are skips because I didn't even bother entering, were any of the Mamba de Kobe's or the Air Max 1 Jackie Robinson. I just didn't wake up at 7 a.m. PST for those. And I'm pretty sure, I think I said this before, but someone at Nike must have sat Vanessa Bryant down and said, hey, look, here's how it's going to go. You know, the whole FBI interrogation room with a single light over the table, and said, look, we can't GR every single Kobe sneaker. It would kill the whole biz. So we'll do a Halo series once in a while where it has these bigger numbers and those are just white shoes, so it's never gonna affect any of the other sneakers. And eventually, you know, they ground her down and she understood and agreed. And so that's where we are now, back to super limited Kobe drops. I also tried for these Bodhi Astro Grabbers, and these feel like a shoe where Nike needed an answer for the Wales Bonner Samba. So they said, Here you are with this archival football shoe. That'll do. That looks like a flat terrace shoe. And I do talk about this later in the whole Nike segment. It's kind of sad seeing Nike trend jacking instead of trend setting, but I guess you need a mixture of both. And I don't know. You know, Bodhi does a lot of textile-inspired clothing. All the clothing looks like it's a, you know, taken inspiration from every ethnic grandma in New York City. She just kind of accosted every person's grandma and said, can I see your doilies? Show me your knitwear. And then, you know, went off and made a shirt out of it. And she is married to a brown guy. And I think a lot of the stuff is made in India. So I guess she's on the team then. But the mainline Bodhi clothing, it seems nice enough for that audience. You know, it's not made for me. I always check it out on Essence when it pops up there, and the size guide will show that the length for like the biggest size, like the XL, is often like 25 inches length. And I, you know, I'm 6'2". I need a minimum of like 29 inches height on a top. And so if I wore that, my gut would be sticking out. But it's not made for me. It's clothing made for a G&D Leon. And the Nike clothing with this whole collab, I don't know. It just looked like it was taken from the set of In Living Colors Men on Film segment. The shoes, however, look decent enough. It looks like something you could either dress up or dress down. And so I like the shoes. They're definitely sneakers I could have wore with just black pants to work one day if I go into the office. So I was like, yeah, I'll try it because I wasn't exactly sure at the hype level. And so the drop was, you know, early before the official sneakers app drop, which is in May. But usually what happens is when a new collaborator who's got their first ever hype sneaker gets, you know, a collaboration, they usually fuck up the release somehow, either because they just didn't know or they didn't care or a combination of both. In this case, Bodhi put the site in password mode, but they did not disable the Instagram integration. So if you just search on their Instagram page and search Nike, you could have bought that stuff 10 minutes early. So in those 10 minutes, the site was in password mode, the product was loaded, but Instagram had access, so people were just buying straight from Instagram. And so that's why I sent out a tweet that when the site does take password off, that it'll just load out of stock. And it seemed like that's what it did. I can't exactly tell. I wasn't, you know, hands-on looking underneath the hood or anything, but there were some sizes when the site loaded, but it looked like ghost stock because you couldn't cart. And then later when you couldn't check out. And then you were put in a queue. And then the product was pulled and it was sold out. So it's easy to miss like one little checkbox in a thing where you got to turn off the integration with Instagram and Shop Pay and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know if it's intentional or if it's incompetence, either or, it doesn't really matter. But what any collaborator can control is how they communicate and talk about drops. And so here, they were doing a great job before the drop, you know, showing about what's going to drop, showing the sizing guide that these fit narrow and tight, so you should size up. And then after the drop is botched, it was a lot of silence. And then there was a post that everything sold out. Please email us and you'll be put on a wait list if, you know, a size appears. And then that post is deleted and then put in IG stories. But kudos for them for saying something, I guess. Usually brands say nothing. Because the order is already in. So like when you got people's money, are you going to go to the bank and take out that money and then hand it back out to the people who gave you the money? No, you're going to keep the money. But the other thing is that you can treat sneakerheads like shit because sneakerheads are used to this kind of stuff. They're used to Nike and Jordan brand treating you like shit. You can treat resellers like shit because they deserve it. So but, you know, if you looked at the Instagram comments for this Bodhi drop, there was a lot of just like regular Bodhi customer type people who don't know about this kind of stuff, had no shot at it, didn't know about the Instagram integration or anything like that, and they're upset about it. So, you know, Bodhi's probably worrying about appeasing them and not about anybody else. Next up, I was going to talk about the Hidden New York ASICS sneaker, the Gel NYC sneaker. Hidden New York, if you don't know, is this mood board / streetwear brand on Instagram. And they have their first like big collaboration that's not a custom painted sneaker that they did previously with the Gel NYC. The Gel NYC, it's like almost a good silhouette. I don't know. For me, there's something just missing with it. So I haven't bought a pair, but you know, there's been various collaborations with that sneaker over time. And so I saw people posting about it after the early drop that it's a sneaker of the year contender. And so before I talk about that, I have to obviously talk about, I have some history with Hidden New York. He was a dick to me in the DMs. I recapped it all in like episode 9 of this podcast. So if you want to check it out way back then, I'm not going to rehash it all, but it was a long time ago. You know, I'm not trying to get too deep into the hating world. You know, obviously, despite me having shows called The Hater's Guide and, you know, me having a list of enemies and stuff, but as I said, usually I've helped those people and they haven't helped me. But in this case, it was just me making a point that was definitely fair and the guy was an asshole to me. And so that's all I really need to know about someone. So I don't really hate Hidden New York. It's just an Instagram account. It's nothing. And I know the common refrain is like, oh, you're just jealous of him. And I'm not jealous of him at all. What am I jealous of? He doesn't believe in anything, which I'll get to. What does he stand for? He stands for nothing, which I'll get to. And so that also doesn't mean I'm cool with the guy or need to like and support anything they do, because I don't give a fuck about them. That's it. So when I saw a Twitter post by @ChefDoomy that this is a sneaker of the year contender, I was like, whatever, everyone's entitled to their opinion. I get why people will like the account and this shoe. That's fine. And then I saw another post calling it sneaker of the year contender and others commenting and more. And that's when I was like, nope, this will not do. It's time to finally push my own agenda here. But first, I found this like popular retweet of it saying, "Hidden New York, not even being from New York, makes these trash." And so for a lot of people, that was their first time finding out that this hidden New York guy is not from New York. He's just some British dude. And I had obviously made this point several times before, so I retweeted an old tweet of mine. It says, "Get your Japanese inspired, made in LA clothing from a New York brand started by someone from the UK. Which isn't, you know, is accurate, is exactly what it is. The headquarters of this guy's company is in LA. He lives in New York, he's from the UK, and he makes Japanese inspired t-shirts and stuff sometimes. Obviously that's phrased in a joking way, but that kind of gets to my main criticism of Hidden New York, and I think is a fair criticism, despite me being a hater, as I previously said, is that Hidden New York is someone that has no point of view at all. Other than he used to be a graphic designer and gave it up for a mood board, and it became a big hit. You know, what is his point of view on anything? Pictures of Sega Dreamcast and vintage stereos is not a point of view. Stolen pics from dormant Tumblr accounts is not a point of view. Reposting the same image you posted exactly 8 months ago is not a point of view. This is fine if you're just into aesthetics and things being cool and looking cool. And that's fine to do like a single collab, like even like Hard Copy Instagram account did. But once you venture into a streetwear brand, the ethos of streetwear is you gotta believe in something. This guy believes in nothing but pirated versions of Adobe Photoshop because he used to be a graphic designer. I mean, if you're around from back in the way, everyone did that. You think I don't know what GMV keyboard shortcuts are in Photoshop? I've been in the Photoshop mind since version 4.0. That, you know, that is not a point of view. I've never even like talked about it ever. So as I said, every other streetwear brand believes in something. Even Jound has sort of a point of view and they believe in something. This guy believes in nothing. This past, present, future gimmick is basically the absence of a point of view. So the entire point of view seems to be vapid and vacant and filled with old Tumblr photos. And, you know, these are the cool Tumblr photos. And cool things don't represent you. You represent you. Old Tumblr photos do not communicate thoughts. There's nothing deep or meaningful there at all. And one of the issues, of course, is that he's anonymous. He prefers to be anonymous. He, you know, lets the old Tumblr photos talk for him. He's just some British guy named Corey. And obviously, I get being anonymous. I've been anonymous for a long time, but I've not exactly hid my thoughts and opinions on anything. They've always been front and center. And like I said, him being a dick to me and him being a dick to his ex-manager, that's all I need to know. So he's probably a dick to a lot of people. You know, put that out there. Show people that you're an asshole. He does have like a subscribers-only Substack, and that's where he has like paid members and maybe he does have a point of view behind a paywall, and I checked it out. You know, the articles and headlines are free, but once you click it, you have to pay. Some looked fine. Some look like junk, like the art of Minecraft. Like, how old are you, dude? And then the second one I clicked on, the alt tag of the header image said Tumblr. Just like I said, you're letting the Tumblr photos talk for you. So obviously, I didn't check it all out. Maybe he does write more on there. Maybe he does have a point of view on there. But it's behind a paywall. It's for paid subscribers only. And that paywall is just a gimmick to, you know, sell you sneakers and sell you the streetwear brand. Give you exclusive access to that. And that's fine. But whatever you're saying in there, it never bubbles up to the timeline. I never see it. Other people don't ever see it. You know, there's this phrase I heard that you don't know these people. And it's so true. Like all these people I talked about previously in the last episode about political beliefs or what they believe in. We really don't know these people and they only share a version of themselves online. This guy shares barely a sliver that he used to use Photoshop. That's it. But obviously he has fans. He has fans that paid subscribers for his written word and his brand and collab shoes and all that stuff. I'm sure stores are happy that a shoe came along that is moving really quickly and it's not sitting on the shelves. You know, none of that can't take away from him. If you like it, I love it, as the phrase says when, you know, you think something is junk that people like. Because, you know, you're buying into something or someone who curates cool, and being associated with that makes you cool, right? That's the main draw. Even if it's just, you know, sitting in front of a computer for 8 hours a day reposting, you know, anonymous Instagram accounts. So, you know, I'm not really trying to convince you to hate the guy and to join my army and take sides. I don't play any of this that way. I'm just sharing my point of view, sharing something I don't see that many other people talking about. So if you like the shoe, like the shoe. If it's sneaker of the year for you, that's great. If you like photos of a fern in front of a Jordan 4, that's great. All that kind of stuff is just empty calories. It's chewing gum with no depth, no substance, and something you spit out when the flavor is gone. I mentioned at the top that Nike has partnered with GOAT for these Air Max 1 Ducks of a Feather releases. One released on GOAT app where there was 3,000 pairs and the other on Flight Club where there's 225 pairs. The Flight Club one was interesting because it's probably the first drop in New York City for a sneaker in a while where the profits were in the thousands. So we haven't seen that in a long time. So people were out, people were buying bands, people sold bands way too cheap for like a few $100. And then the people who bought the bands turned around and flipped those shoes for thousands of dollars. The game is the game in New York City, of course. But in both cases, both Flight Club and GOAT, the buyer of the sneaker couldn't immediately relist it on those platforms. They had to wait 60 days. So it was like a moratorium. So looks like something that Nike had put in place so that there wouldn't be immediate flips, so that it gives Nike some distance away from these platforms, even though they're working with these resale platforms. And of course, Flight Club owns GOAT, or GOAT owns Flight Club, whatever it is. It's the same company. Foot Locker owns a portion of them as well, too. And the purpose of all this is that it supports the Oregon Sports, Oregon University, NIL program, name, image, likeness. Ducks of a Feather is, they have this whole convoluted thing where Phil Knight is related to that. But basically the point of it is that instead of giving players player-exclusive sneakers that they could turn around and sell on the black market and they can get in trouble for it, here, they can sell it on these platforms, get a lot of money, and that money then goes to these student programs or students themselves. So the point of that is to make as much money as possible, but Nike has not listed these sneakers for $1,000 right away. They've taken it slow. They're selling them for $225 or maybe $300. My guess is they'll eventually raise the prices of that. And that is the reason why they're using these platforms, because if they had it on their own site, if they had it on a Nike site and it said the retail price is $1,000, people would be like, what the fuck is Nike doing charging $1,000 for a sneaker? But if GOAT is selling a sneaker for $1,000 and Nike gave them all those sneakers, there's enough of a leeway there, a distance, that that's not us selling it, that's GOAT selling it, even though you didn't get those sneakers without Nike giving them to you. They actually used to do this with StockX. They've sold some Jordan 8s, Oregon Jordan 8s with StockX before they eventually sued them. So they probably realized we can't have a partnership and have StockX sell these sneakers if we're suing them in court. And it's hilarious because in court, Nike is basically saying that resale marketplaces, resale apps can't be trusted because they can't authenticate Nike sneakers. And the background, of course, is related to the whole NFT thing where StockX is selling NFTs and they have a real shoe in the vault. And in that process, Nike lawyers have claimed that because StockX can't possibly authenticate every sneaker, only Nike can. So that sneaker in the vault could potentially be fake. So if you kind of infer that, that's the same thing applies to any resale marketplace, to eBay, to GOAT. Of course, the difference here is Nike is directly providing GOAT or Flight Club with these shoes. But at the same time, they're saying these marketplaces can't fully be trusted because they can't fully authenticate these sneakers. So to summarize, they're basically saying people could get fakes on StockX. They, by inference, you can also get fakes from eBay and from GOAT. Then at the same time, you're also working with GOAT. So that's what I meant. It's kind of rich. It's hilarious. And, you know, I don't really believe that Nike believes this, that this is just an argument they had to use to try to win a case. Once that case is settled, eventually they will drop any of these claims about these marketplaces can't be trusted and go about their way. But overall, this whole nil thing gives Nike the distance that they need so that people can look the other way, that they're working with resale platforms. Also wanted to talk about Nike products and Nike marketing lately. And, you know, the common refrain is that Nike is a marketing company that makes sneakers and not, you know, a product sneaker company first. Or, you know, instead of marketing, they call it demand creation. And we saw this marketing recently with Air Max Month and this Air Max DN rollout, which I've talked about a little bit in previous episodes. And obviously they did a ton of marketing for this DN because they had to. It's a new silhouette and the shoe, you know, it isn't exactly fire, you know, to quote Greg from the Sneak Diss, it sucks but doesn't suck. So they got to go into promo mode for a shoe that's meant to be for the general audience, meant to replace the Air Max 270 for that kind of crowd. And, you know, not necessarily the sneakerhead crowd, but sneakerheads are always early adopters for this kind of stuff. And us as sneakerheads, you know, we talk about this stuff on Twitter and on podcasts and stuff because you're a fan of the company, you're invested in the company, and therefore you want good marketing from them. You want them to sell the product, to grow and be successful and all that kind of stuff so you can have more good product. That, you know, that's where it essentially comes from. So people have these opinions that, you know, they should be doing marketing on this, they should be marketing their collabs, they should be doing marketing for this product and too much for this product and not enough for this another one. An example of this is the Jordan 2 with the Jordan 3 sole that came out. You know, wasn't exactly marketed. It was just released to stores. The Gentry guy leaked them a few months ago, and then they were in stores, and they're already like on sale at a lot of places with discount codes, 20, 30% off. And you can have the opinion that, you know, they could have had something here if they just marketed right. But how they treat the shoe tells you a lot about how they think about that shoe. It basically tells you that they thought that the shoe is basically made to be available in malls and on the Foot Locker wall and will probably do well in those places, even if it does go on sale. They didn't exactly market it as hype because it wasn't earmarked for hype. It was earmarked for the scale and money part of the brand, which is, you know, the real goal of Jordan brand is making money on their Team Jordans and stuff like that. And even the high retail prices, when they go on sale, they still make more money than when they had lower retail. And but what I mean by that is if a shoe was previously at $160 retail and it was 30% off, 30% off is $112. I did this math before I recorded this part. And so now if you raise the retail of that sneaker to $180 and it's now 30% off, you can sell it for $126. That's an extra $14. That's what I mean, where they still make a little bit more change even though the same shoe is going for 30% off. And, you know, the amount of shoes they make and what's available and stuff, I know they're adjusting all that and stuff. I talked about this previously where, you know, the normal cycle is they're supposed to release a lot, then pull back a bit. And it seemed like for this last year or so, they've been in this kind of holding pattern, probably because of this numbers guy CEO that they have. But overall, they're going to spend marketing money for the general consumer to create demand there, not from the hype consumer, because the hype consumer creates demand themselves. And there was an article in Reuters recently that how Nike bosses are planning a big marketing spend for the Olympics. And that's, you know, a perfect event where you can get the general audience to take a look at your product. That article said they're spending like $1 billion on marketing, up 10% from the same period last year. And in that article, there's also some exec quoted saying that they're going to do fewer marketing campaigns, but bigger ones. And that basically tells you that they're not going to market it for anything that's hype, because how often is a hype collab actually really big? You know, something like the 10 was big, but those are once every few years. Olympics are big, but that's not exactly hype. In the same article, they talked about how that is contrast with Adidas, because Adidas has been cutting back on marketing spend and Nike has been increasing it. Adidas has their own concern because their whole write-off with Yeezy and stuff like that. But the issue is, you can spend all this money in marketing, but lately, the Nike product has been kind of shitty as well, too. When they debuted in France, the outfits that the Olympians were wearing, they had the two, you know, male and female track outfits on these little dummies on stage, and female Olympians were like, this thing looks graphic. And one lady even said, my entire hoo-ha will be showing. And then at that whole event, they had all these people, these athletes on stage. I retweeted this photo from Lois Sacani, and they were all wearing these ill-fitting outfits. And none of it looked good, and a lot of it looked shitty. And speaking of that, they debuted these AI sneakers at that Paris thing as well, too. something I talked about on this podcast last year. So, you know, tell a friend, tell them to listen to the Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast, and you'll hear me forecast things a year before they happen. And those AI sneakers look like shit. They didn't look wearable at all. And really, an AI doesn't actually need to think about the physics of a foot hitting the ground in sport and cutting and things like that. It can just design whatever wavy concept shit that it wants. You know, they talked about how they're designed with the Nike AI engineering lab at the same time. So, you know, potentially those are the people that are supposed to worry about that kind of stuff, the physics on the foot. But overall, it just looked like how car companies would show off a concept car that's a marketing stunt. And the difference is those concept cars always looked cool. This shit did not look cool. It looked like a joke. Honestly, if I was an executive at Nike, I would have canceled that entire AI thing. But this is what I mean. They have a numbers guy as a CEO, not a shoe dog. That guy knows about numbers. He doesn't know about what's cool. But, you know, it wasn't all bad. That full-length zoom on the Pegasus shoe, that looked pretty cool. But even that, it's going to be priced at like $250. There's a limit when you price something at $250 versus $160, $180. Besides, how many times has Nike lauded some new innovation as the next big thing, and it's not really at all? They said that the VaporMax was going to be a running shoe. It's not a running shoe. The DN, it's just whatever. They had this Joyride, Nike Joyride, where they had the beads in the heel, and one running shoe site basically deemed it the worst running shoe they've ever reviewed of all time. You know, whenever they talk about sustainability and stuff like that, at the same time, they were putting little beads in the heel of a shoe for the birds to eventually eat when they land in the landfill. Another thing with the shitty products is this whole Nike and Fanatics deal with MLB. They have a deal where they are making all the jerseys and the gear that the baseball players wear in MLB. And it's supposed to be engineered and designed by Nike, but made by Fanatics. And so the blame here could be on either or, but if it's on either or, it's on both. If they are making a shitty product, was the design shitty or was the quality the Fanatics made shitty? Even if it's on Fanatics, it's Nike that signed off and designed it. So they're both equally to blame. And if you don't follow MLB, that jerseys, that gear looks like shit. It looks like a replica. The lettering is off. Players are complaining that they can't tailor pants because it's kind of like one size fits all. So some guys with big thighs can't fit in them, and some, you know, skinny pitcher is swimming in them. And, you know, that's on Nike engineering. Nike is the one who signed off and designed all these jerseys. One of the players, he was sliding in for home and his pants ripped as he was sliding for home base. The funniest quote I saw was from a Reds catcher, Luke Mail, saying that changing jerseys is like kind of changing toilet paper. You notice it at first, but after a while, it's just your toilet paper. So the pinnacle of sports engineering, Nike, their product for MLB, is now being compared to shitty hotel toilet paper. So overall, shitty product leads to shitty marketing, and neither helps you look cool or fun at all. It just looks like no one's having any fun. And the product is shit and people know it's shit, but can't do anything about it because corners have been cut somewhere. And now Olympians are saying that their hoo-ha will be on display and your product is being compared to toilet paper. That's not going to be good for anyone. And it also doesn't help that the CEO of Nike, John Donahue, is basically blaming employees and laying them off. And they're doing these rolling layoffs, which, you know, conventional wisdom for business and layoffs is you cut once and cut deep, which is, of course, shitty. But basically, it's like once it's been decided, everyone else who's there can proceed and kind of restart from there. Whereas if you just hang it over employees' heads that we're going to do some layoffs now at Christmas, you know, Merry Christmas, you're laid off. Then the rest in Nike Q4, which is like coming up now, May to June is when Nike Q4 is. So they're basically telling employees, hey, if you're working on a project right now, work really hard on it, finish it up, and your reward might be that you get a pink slip at the end. And at the same time, Nike is dumping money into this NFT stuff that barely has any traction these days. And, you know, they're not shuttering this whole Dot Swoosh division down. They're, you know, pouring money into it because cutting that would kind of be like admitting defeat. You got to cut elsewhere. So Nike morale, the employee morale, must be in the toilet. So when you have shitty morale, you're not going to make good product. And these are the people that are capable of making good product at all levels. So they make plenty of cool stuff. They have this huge advantage over any other sneaker brand because they have this archive of products that people love. And they do hype products, energy, and RG better than anyone else. And they can do that every once in a while when they want to. The Nike Supreme stuff, this Nike Bodhi stuff. You know, that looks like a decent campaign on its own. Even if overall it seems like a late reaction to Wales, Bonner, and Samba. And a Nike trend-jacking instead of trend-setting. So, you know, they could do a lot more marketing in this field to make themselves look cool and fun because this is stuff that they do well. But they've basically said they won't because this stuff is limited and it will sell itself. We don't need to create that much demand for it. We need to create demand at the Olympic level. We need to have fewer campaigns that are bigger. But as I said, marketing will only cover up some of the flaws. A shitty product is a shitty product. You can't put lipstick on a pig. So they got to fix that. They got to stop cutting corners. That probably means they got to get rid of their numbers guy, CEO. But the business guy, the stockholders, Phil Knight, they probably love this numbers guy, CEO. So, you know, they got no one else to blame but themselves. But as we know with C-suite people, they don't blame themselves. They blame employees. And that's what this guy did. He blamed employees for working from home, that they can't innovate when they're working from home. You know, that Nike Joyride sneaker that I talked about that released a few years ago, the worst running sneaker ever made, that was designed when people were at the office. So it's not about working from home, from what I can tell. It's about the leadership, about cutting corners. You have the archive and you have the employees that can create good product. You just need the leadership that will then support them. So really, this sword of Damocles hanging over employees' head, you know, they're not the ones with the power here. The sword of Damocles is supposed to be over someone who's got power. So it should be the sword of Donahue. It should be hanging over his head. He's the one that should be gone, but he'll only be gone if the stock price says he should be gone. All right, my big Japan trip. I'm going to talk about my trip to Japan, what it was like, what the people were like, what they were wearing, shopping, and thoughts on the country. You know, I'm not really going to talk about sightseeing and every single thing I saw. That's the stuff I thought that would be interesting for you if you're going or planning a trip to Japan. And first off, I just want to note that this was a family trip. I was going with my wife and kids. And so the point of this trip was not like a content creator trip. I wasn't there to create TikToks and Instagram reels and go see every single thing and take a photo of a thing that would look awesome on social media. The point of it was to show my kids the world, to show them a part of the world that's different from the West. It wasn't to be like, hey, kids, let's go check out the Double Taps showroom. Usually we just do relaxing vacations like in California or Hawaii. We haven't really done an adventure type of vacation before. I hadn't even been on a long international flight in almost 20 years. So it just felt like it was time. It just felt like, you know, I don't got any time to get old, so I better go do the things that I want to go do and go see the things I want to see. So that's why we went. So the outline for the trip was spend the first 4 days or so in Tokyo, because that's where we're flying into, and then take a bullet train to Kyoto, and then spend 4 days there, and then spend the last 6 days or so in Tokyo again. So the plan was to do more of the sightseeing up front, and then do the shopping later in the last half. So that way you're not carrying extra stuff around. And that was the plan. We didn't really plan out anything extra other than that. We kind of left it open. There was some stuff where we had booked the Team Labs Museum and things like that. But other than that, that was it. It was just kind of, once you get there, you get a feel for it. The one kind of a tourist thing I wanted to do was I wanted to go see a pro wrestling in person. I wanted to go see Stardom or New Japan Pro Wrestling, but they were always in different cities while we were there. DDT Pro Wrestling was there in Ueno when I was there, but I was just too tired that night, and so we didn't end up going out for that. So it just didn't work out, but that's all right. You know, it was kind of weird that both those promotions kind of imploded while we were there, but oh well, maybe next time. That concludes the pro wrestling segment of the Sockjig Sneaker Podcast. In terms of planning for going to Japan, you know, your number one tool right now is really TikTok or Instagram. there's just people on there. There's travel influencers, and all they do is create little TikToks and little reels about every single little thing. Just search like Tokyo restaurants on Instagram, load the first video, and then just start scrolling. You'll see restaurant after restaurant, person creating video after video. There's just so many of these travel creators that are making this kind of evergreen content because a lot of people are going to Japan. And, you know, I assume they're going there and filming a ton of content and then coming back and then just posting videos about it for a few months. And then, you know, 8 months later, there's more people coming. So you can just reuse those same videos. So you do definitely get a lot of tips from those kind of videos, and there's a lot of useless ones. And you just use the Instagram save feature on there. And that's what I did. There's also a lot of people that gave suggestions and ideas on places to go. I want to thank Dennis and Jonathan, Chris and Jeffrey, Edwin on Instagram. I talked to a guy named Fukumak and Skate the Great as well. There's so many people, Dalen and Maurice gave a lot of tips. And if someone would give me a tip, go check out this place on Google Maps on the phone. I would just create a new list for areas of Tokyo or areas of Kyoto, like Shinjuku or Shibuya and stuff like that. And then there's a little notes feature where you just add it in and you say from Jeffrey, from Edwin. In terms of sneakers for going to Japan, I was like, I basically just wanted to take a single pair of sneakers. I wanted to pack as light as possible. I knew there'd be a ton of walking, which kind of rules out every single Nike that I have. I also didn't want to take anything dead stock because, I don't know, it's probably not a good idea to undead stock something in a new country when you're going to have to walk a lot. So you're going to want to take something that I had already worn a lot, but which hadn't already flattened out. So my candidates were either a Gelcano 14, which I always wear, or the Action Bronson New Balance 990 V6 Baklava one that I always wear. That was my sneaker of the year. And that was the one I ended up taking because it was worn in, it was not flattened out. I didn't think anyone else would have it, so you can like flex a little bit in it. It's colorful, and it really worked out well. I wore it every day for 2 weeks, and now I kind of don't want to wear it anymore, so I'm kind of sick of it. In terms of clothing, we went in the last 2 weeks of March, so it was still a little bit cold there. And the goal was to kind of pack as light as possible because we're moving cities, and I didn't want to carry stuff around everywhere. At first, I was like, I'm just going to go to Uniqlo when I get there. I'm going to buy a bunch of socks and underwear, and then each day just wear it and throw it out. But didn't end up having to do that because every place that we went to had a laundry. So we just ended up, you know, just doing laundry every single day in the hotel. It's just a single machine that does washing and drying, and it would often take like 2-3 hours. So just set it and we would leave and come back and everything would be clean. So because we're going in late March, it's still kind of cold there. We had to dress for the cold spring weather, but at the same time, you know, I just didn't want to wear only like tech gear. I kind of wanted to dress up a bit because, you know, living in Vancouver, we just wear tech gear all the time anyways. And you're going to like, you know, a fashion capital like Tokyo, Japan. So, you know, I kind of took both. In terms of what I took with me, starting from my head top, sorry, that's me speaking Toronto all of a sudden and me apologizing for it, I guess is me speaking Canadian. So my hat I took was my Palace horsepower hat. This is a neon green with real tree, and it says like Palace Unchained Melody or something like that on the top. I wore that because it'd be easy for my family to spot me because I'm 6'2", and you could just look for a guy in a neon green hat. I took my Dunhill gold frames that I got from Davon from Loose Laces podcast. In terms of jackets, I took a white mountaineering Adidas track jacket and a white mountaineering Gore-Tex shell for the days that it rained. So those are the only two jackets, like I said, I was going to take at first, but then I was like, you know what, I got to show out a little bit. So I packed my Army Green Junya Watanabe CDG Bomber as well, and that's an expensive jacket. It's the most I've spent on a jacket, but I just kind of believe that you should get the item and cherish the item and wear it a lot. If you have the item, it fits me really well, and it's one of those like oversized Japanese fashion fits, but I'm a big guy, it fits me perfect, so it works out well. In terms of tops, I packed a lot of jerseys because they pack so light. I have this Maradona Adidas 94 a jersey. I have this Martine Rose Mr. Chasing a Dream jersey that I bought. I brought a June Jay black shirt with a zipper thing that I have in case I wanted to go to a fancy restaurant. And then I just packed a bunch of t-shirts. And in terms of pants, I just wear these Lululemon black pants that are just so comfortable. You can wear them on the plane. You can wear them every day there. I did take these Anne Wonder tech type of pants that I have. But I didn't end up wearing them that often. I ended up actually wearing these Outdoor Voices track pants that I got. Shout out to my friend Doug, who suggested these from the Essence site. They're only like $50 or so, but they're super light, super easy to wear, and they have like UV protection and such. Once you get there, it does take a while to get over the jet lag. There is a 16-hour time difference from the Pacific time zone to Tokyo time. So there were many times where I was like wide awake at like 4 a.m. Tokyo time. And even on the first day there, we felt an earthquake at 6 a.m. and the bed was shaking a little bit. I looked out the window and no one seemed to be very panicked. And then I was searching Twitter for Japan earthquake, and there was one in like Fukushima, which is hours away in the ocean or something. So, you know, got to check that off, that I got to experience an earthquake while I was in Tokyo. So everything else, once you're there, it's like, you know, it sounds so silly to say, but it's like, oh shit, everything's in a different language here. It really does just kind of, you know, bombard the senses. The other thing that you see is that it's very clean. There's no garbage cans. People just carry their garbage around and they're expected to carry it around and dump it when they get home. I don't know, that only works in Japan. I don't think that would work anywhere else. But once you're there, it's a very safe country. You don't see any bikes locked up. You see laptops just sitting out at Starbucks. People feel very comfortable. You don't have to be completely on edge all the time, which was one of the reasons I wanted to take my kids there, because, you know, obviously as a parent, you're still going to be on edge a little bit, just not cranked up to 10 like it would be if I was in New York City with my kids. It feels kind of weird comparing Tokyo to New York City. Obviously, it has a big city feel, but Tokyo is its own thing. It's got its own feel. You know, the only part that felt like New York-ish to me was the Ginza area of Tokyo, but really, it's the people that make a city feel like how it's supposed to feel. It's the New Yorkers that make New York feel that way. And just like in Japan, it's the Japanese people that make any city in Japan feel that way, that make Tokyo feel like Tokyo. You know, an example of this, the first morning I was there, I walk out, I'm getting breakfast, I'm just by myself. It's super early because of the jet lags, and the streets are basically empty. And I'm at a crosswalk, I see a guy across from me, he's waiting at the red light for the crosswalk to turn green as well too. But it's like empty in the streets. And so because he's not jaywalking, I'm not going to jaywalk. And then I know that that's the culture. I don't want to stick out. You just got to kind of fit in, is the Japanese kind of mindset. And so he's waiting, I'm waiting. And I was just thinking, like, I would never see this in any other city in New York City. Can you expect a New Yorker to just wait at a red light by himself in an empty street at 7 a.m. on a Sunday morning? No. You know, once you're out in the city and once you're walking around, one thing that does take a while to get used to is people walk on the left side, just like how they drive on the left side. And in North America, you're just used to walking and driving on the right side. So sometimes I'd be walking down the street and all of a sudden you just see a wave of people walking right at me. And I'm like, oh shit, I got to move over to the left side. Or you do and you remember, and then you turn a corner and you forget. All of a sudden you just turn the corner and you're walking on the right side again. And then same thing would happen, and a whole bunch of people are walking right at you and you'd have to move over. And that's the other tip, is you can do a ton of walking. You got to manage your energy. If you're sightseeing, you should go early and come back in the afternoon and rest, or just sleep in, go late, and then stay out late and get dead tired, which is kind of what we did most of the time. But you do a lot of walking, it gets tiring. It's just hard to manage sightseeing and shopping and all that kind of stuff, and then finding somewhere to eat. Like, you're always kind of going to be in a navigator mode unless you are super meticulous and plan out every single thing. In terms of cash and money, you know, there's a sentiment that it's a very cash-based country, and it is much more than North America. The U.S. used to be very much cash-based before COVID, but now it's not at all. The last few times I've been to San Francisco and California. And the same in Japan, there's a ton of places that had credit card and even tap and stuff like that. So you're going to need cash, though, for any smaller restaurants, any like food stall and things like that. So it's good to carry it around. In terms of the language, it wasn't a huge issue at all in Tokyo, especially in stores. If you're in less touristy parts, or, you know, wander into a locals only restaurant, if you're just, you know, getting lost in Tokyo, then maybe you're going to have to pull out the Google Translate app. And, you know, there's times I had to use that, especially on menus. And, you know, sometimes you could get an English menu and it's kind of incomplete. It doesn't tell you the list of ingredients. So, you know, if someone doesn't eat pork or something on that, you could use the Google Translate app to see. In terms of like phrases, all you really need to know is konnichiwa, bitches. No, obviously don't need to know konnichiwa, bitches. That's from a Dave Chappelle sketch. Really, all you need to know is hi, or you could just do a thumbs up. I probably just did the thumbs up more often. No, I never figured out. I think it's ER or something like that. Whatever it is, you could just shake your head and say no, because no is universal. But the two phrases you just need to know are sumimasen, which is excuse me, and arigato gozaimasu, which is just thank you very much when someone helps you. So at first, I didn't know how to say it. Maybe I even did mispronounce it at first, and I would just like mumble it. I would be like, arigato gozaimasu. And then by the end, you just have to like pick up on the sing-songy way that people would be saying it to you. So then you just say it right back to them. They'd be like, arigato gozaimasu, arigato gozaimasu. And then you, that's it. You just have to do it in a sing-songy way, and they figure it out. So that's all you really need to know. You can, like I said, you can go on Instagram Reels and they'll start teaching you all this language and Duolingo and all that kind of stuff, but you'll forget it by the time you get there. Those phrases are basically all you need to know. In terms of food, food is good everywhere. There's a population of like 30 million or whatever it is in Tokyo, so there's going to be a ton of restaurants. And the thing about Japan is it's expensive to get there. It's expensive to stay at hotels, but once you're there, the food and transit and trains and stuff like that is all cheap. There were times where we would go out, a meal for four would be like 4,000, 5,000 yen, which is like $25 US, $30 US in that range. Of course, there's like pricier restaurants, but still, you'd end up spending like $60, $70 US versus, you know, 120 plus. The other thing with Tokyo and Japan and these big cities and just condensed cities, it has like a bodega culture. It's just called Konbini for convenience store. So the 7-Elevens, the Family Mart, the Lawson stores, they're just basically everywhere. And they're not like the 7-Elevens here where it's just, you know, a hot dog that's been under a heat lamp for 40 years. There's full-on like food. There's people making like fried chicken in the back and stuff like that. So it's actually good. There's ATMs in there. You can buy like tickets and all kinds of stuff in there. So that's where we would go for breakfast every morning. You just buy these egg sandwiches in there, which ended up being like a dollar or something each. And Family Mart makes these fried chicken patties. And a popular hack is to just combine the egg sandwich and the chicken patty. So I did that a few times, but, you know, obviously did not want to eat fried chicken every single morning. And so we would just go there all the time to, you know, raid for snacks. And you could just load up on snacks at all these places. And even for dessert, the killer ice cream dessert there at the 7-Eleven was this creme brulee. If you go to Japan, buy the creme brulee ice cream at the 7-Eleven. It comes out to like a dollar or two. And I don't know how they did it, but it's in a little tiny like flat cup and it's got a creme brulee like topping at the top. And you have to kind of tap it and let it melt a bit. And then you get these chunks of creme brulee underneath is like a, you know, a vanilla or creamy ice cream. Awesome, especially for like a dollar or two. And so while we were there, you know, the four of us as a family, we didn't exactly stand in line for a tiny hole in the wall ramen place that everyone tells you to go to that is super popular. It's just too hard for the kids. So we went to other types of restaurants and really it's hard to go wrong. There's sushi, the katsu, the fried stuff, izakaya, ramen. There's all kinds of restaurants. We went to a conveyor belt sushi restaurant, which is fire. You just order everything on this little iPad and a little conveyor belt comes down to your table and it drops it off. And you can only order four items at a time. But the items would literally come in like 5 minutes or so. So there's also a restaurant where you just go sit at a table and order from an iPad. And then this robot brings you all the food. So I tried most of those places. The only thing I didn't get to try was shabu shabu, which is like a hot pot type of thing. But it was all good. Every single meal I had there was awesome. And, you know, if you have some sort of dietary restrictions with vegetarian or don't eat pork and stuff, you definitely got to pull out that Google Translate app and look for it and work a little bit harder because that is kind of in everything. And if it's not, maybe the broth might be made out of pork or whatever. But I don't know. You can work at it and you can definitely find those places if you look hard enough. In terms of like transportation, I mentioned like the trains are really easy to figure out. They're really cheap. Every line is like a color and has like a name. The most popular one in Tokyo is this Yamanote line. And so every spot has like a number like Yamanote JY3 and you need to go to JY10. That's it. Google Maps is your friend. It tells you everything. It tells you to go on this platform number. And then when you get off at JY10, go to exit number 4. And often I would just screenshot that from Google Maps instead of having it drain my battery. The other thing I forgot to talk about earlier is that getting from the airport, I just use the limousine bus. It's way easier than trying to get on the train and carrying luggage on a train. The train might be faster, but on the bus, you just have to find where that bus is dropping off at closest to your hotel. They take the luggage and then you can just like kind of zone out. It takes a little bit longer, but probably much better than the train and cheaper too. There's also taxis everywhere, and there are all these older cars, these black cars, and the taxi drivers are wearing suits, so it looks really cool. Definitely saw a lot of more elderly people, like older people driving taxis and stuff, so, you know, it's one of those things, it's like, is that cool to see? It's cool that the guy's out working, or is it that a state of the country is that the guy has to work? I don't know, the guy took me from A to B. And as I said, you're doing a lot of walking around, so the one thing I didn't really do till like the second week I was there was that if you've been out all day, just flag a taxi. It's way easier than walking down to finding the train station and navigating your way there. At first, I used Uber, which, you know, just connects to the taxi service, but that was kind of slow. You can just wave one down. Each time I tried, I got one in literally in 30 seconds. And, you know, they might not speak English, especially the older drivers that I mentioned, but you can just show them the address of your hotel and they're going to need to see the Japanese address, not the English one. So I would just keep a screenshot of it from my hotel reservation or Google Maps. And then I mentioned I went to Kyoto and back. And for that, I did take the bullet train. And I did take like the luxury, the green car as it is, because I figured, you know, how many times am I going to be in Japan? And how many times in my life am I going to be able to take a bullet train that goes like 180 miles per hour. So I just went for it. It was awesome. You can't really get food service on there, but people just get these bento boxes before at each train station and they just eat them on the way. It was awesome. I recommend it. It's expensive. It's much more expensive than it used to be, but I don't know. We got from Tokyo to Kyoto in like 2 hours and 15 minutes or so. So those are my tips of going to Japan. Like I said, if you need more help on any of that kind of stuff, you can feel free to ask me. But TikTok and Instagram really is your friend. Just search for, you know, bullet train Kyoto and you'll find everything you need to know by some random content creator who made a video about it. In terms of like the Japanese people while I was there, what they were wearing, sneakers, I honestly did not see a ton of Nike. Of course, you'd see the usual ones and you'd see a lot of Dunks and Jordan 1 mids, but just like a random person on the train, it would be more often wearing a New Balance or Japanese brands. Like that's what I saw way more than Nike. Obviously, when you got to the busier parts of like Shibuya or Shinjuku, you'd see more hype stuff. But New Balance, I saw a ton of. A lot of that 327 sneaker, which I don't see much of in Vancouver these days. I don't know, maybe in other cities is still very popular. But I saw a ton of those 327s, ton of the 574 types, and even a lot of 2002 Rs, like that model is still going strong. You'd see some Asics, and I did see On sneakers on some people, some locals. Hoka, I only ever saw on tourist. But, you know, there's so many times where I was looking at a shoe, and I was like, I have no idea what that is. And it'd be like a sneaker with two stripes or two chevrons and stuff. And even in store sometimes I would be looking at these shoes and it'd be like reproduction of found. I was like, I don't know what that is. And it would be just like the military trainer, like the one that Adidas does and Margiela does, but some company called Reproduction of Found. It's like a Japanese company. And or I saw one, it was called Green Label Relaxing. It's like the perfect kind of Japanese name that just perplexing me, but it's common there, I guess. Sometimes you see these women wearing these big VaporMax like shoes, but it wasn't VaporMax. It was like much more gangly than a VaporMax. And apparently it's a Japanese brand called Grounds. And so I don't know, when the VaporMax is not enough, you got to go for Grounds, I guess. And you definitely saw women wearing a lot of chunky platform shoes and boots and stuff like that. That's a common look for Japanese women. And honestly, it looks awesome about them. So go right ahead. So if they weren't wearing those, they were often wearing other like chunky sneakers. I saw some Filas there, some of those Nike double stacked Air Max that just came out. I saw some flat sole Samba types. You know, one thing I didn't see a lot of was actually Instapump Fury and Uptempos. You know, I was led to believe that everyone in Japan wears Instapump Furies and Uptempos. And one thing that you would often see, especially sightseeing at these temples and stuff, would be couples, like a man and a woman wearing the traditional Japanese attire, like the kimono and whatever the man's version of a kimono is, and they'd be wearing those Japanese flip-flops and damn, they looked uncomfortable, especially, you know, walking all these stairs and stuff at all these temples, but they were wearing it. So I don't know what they were doing there. You know, good blessings on a marriage or a kid or whatever they are. So blessings to them. In terms of clothing, everyone there is dressed well. Like, it's a little jarring to see at first, but you'd never see anyone looking like a slob. You don't see any athleisure, no Lululemon. You don't see anyone wearing shorts, really. Sometimes you'll see women wearing skirts, but those are usually younger women. But like on the trains and stuff, it's just all formal dressing, big coats, either big like pea coat, wool coats, or New Balance puffers and New Balance tech gear, that kind of stuff. So we were there at the start of spring, like I said, the last few weeks of March, so it's still pretty cold, but people are dressing modestly. It's a lot of layers, a lot of big clothing, both the men and the women. As I said, not a lot of skin showing, and that's just part of the Japanese culture, that you just, you know, you don't kind of stand out. You don't try to, like, show out too much. At one point, I was walking down the street, and I was like, damn, there's a lot of people in, like, collarless jackets here. But then I looked down, and I realized I was wearing my Junya bomber. And I also don't have a collar, so that was me fitting in, I guess. And like I said, a lot of people do wear Japanese brands, and it's often jarring to see, like, a brand you just never heard of before. Like, it'll have some random English thing on it, like Sport Avalanche or McLovek or something like that. And I'm like, I don't know what that is or whatever it is. But oftentimes a jumble of words is jarring at first. I'm sure the first time someone saw someone wearing Fear of God Essentials, it's like, that's a random mixture of words. So I was looking for any English type of clothing where it's like some bastardized English saying, and I didn't really see one. And then one day I saw a guy in a black hoodie and it said Snow Bunny on it. It was like a Japanese guy in a black hoodie that said Snow Bunny. So I had a good laugh about that one. In terms of shopping overall, it's awesome there. Because the dollar, the yen is so devalued compared to the US dollar, you get a lot of bang for your buck. You're often saving 20-30%. And a lot of stores have like this tax-free thing where if you show your passport and stuff, or you have to go into a separate lane, and then you don't have to pay the extra tax and stuff. But then they package it all up into like the sealable thing, and you're not supposed to open it until you leave the country, because that's the whole point. If you're going to use it in the country, then you have to pay tax. And you can kind of do that, but there's times where you just, you know, when you're packing, you just rip it apart and pack it in your stuff and go. But overall, the stores are all nice. They're all really well curated. The one thing that was weird about every place, every store, was the heat was just cranked up. You'd go in and people would be just walking around in their wool coats and New Balance puffers, and the heat would be cranked, and you'd be like, what is going on here? I'm like fucking dying here. And people are just walking around in like a full-on trench coat. So when we got to Tokyo, we were staying in an area near the Ikebukuro area, which is like in the northern part. And there's a few department stores near our hotel, so we just walked over there. There's one called Tobu and Parco. And Parco was the first one where downstairs they had like this vintage shop and used stuff. So you walked in, they had like everything. It was like Supreme and sneakers and stuff like that. And I'm not a vintage guy. I don't really look for stuff. And when I was there, right on the bottom shelf, I saw 3 size 12 sneakers, and one of them was a size 12 Air Max 1 Curry, and it was for 5,000 yen, which is like 35 US, maybe even less than that. And so this is when I had just got there. It was like day 2 or so. I'm like, I don't really want to carry this around. So I left it, and then later on, I was like, oh shit, should I cop that one? It was like $35. What am I thinking about? So that was when I first got there. So cut to like a week and a half later when I got back to Tokyo, and we were staying close enough to this area where I just kind of took a train in to check if my size 12 Air Max 1 Curry was still sitting there. And sure enough, there's nobody else in Japan size 12 who wanted to spend 35 US on a pair of Air Max 1 Curries. So I did pick them up, and I was laughing because only in this country, in Japan, would a size 12 at that cheap be sitting around for that long. Any other size, like a size 9.5, would have been gone instantly. But these department stores, they're really nice. There's lots of Japanese brands there mixed with contemporary Western brands. And one of them, there's like a New Balance store, and I had posted some on Twitter. It's like these ankle socks of New Balance ankle socks that have like a New Balance print on the side. And so I finally found them in size extra large for me. So I did pick up those from there. But as I said, overall, in the first week, I wasn't trying to do that much shopping. I was going to leave it for the next week. Also, one of my friends from Montreal was in town in Tokyo at the same time, so we all met up with her, and we went to the Akihabara area, which is like this, imagine a giant arcade. That's what it feels like on the street. It feels like a casino on the street. There's this big Sega building that used to be Sega building, but now it says Gigo, G-I-G-O, I guess. I don't know what that is. You know, if the sign said Sega, it would have been much cooler. And that's where you saw a lot of bars, and you did get a sense of the drinking culture there at nighttime. So if everyone is buttoned up and always trying to be regular, you kind of have to like let it out sometimes, like get drunk and puke on the street. So we definitely saw that. So we didn't spend a ton of time there, you know, went to a few arcades and those claw machines and those capsule kind of places. We also went to Harajuku area. I met up with a friend there and his family, and we went out to Harajuku. I also met up with my friend Kensho. I know some sneaker people know Kensho. He's a manager in the Discords, longtime Showers Gang member, so it was cool to hang out with him. And, you know, in Harajuku, there's this one Takeshita Street, which is this very narrow, very busy, and very touristy area. And so we just had some fun there. And that, you know, that tourist shit is fun when you're in another city and not fun in your own city. But there's just a ton there. There's tons of, like, tourist food things. There's tons of, like, stores in the back streets. Supreme is there. I went into the Supreme. I had to wait a few minutes, and nothing was really there, so we just walked out. So after a few days in Tokyo, we went to Kyoto, and Kyoto is a beautiful city. I really liked it. I loved it a lot. It's much more old Japan style than the modern Tokyo is. We did mostly sightseeing there. We took a day trip to Nara to feed these deer that are sitting in the park. We wanted to go to Osaka, but I missed out on Osaka. I kind of regret that part. So I know there's a lot of cool shops and a cool vibe in Osaka. So next time I go, I'll go there. But Kyoto, we did do some shopping at the Nintendo store and the stationery stores and stuff like that. Back in Tokyo, we were then staying in like the Shinjuku area. And kind of when we got back, we just kind of took it easy a bit, like didn't go all out and just kind of took it more a relaxed approach to stuff. So I didn't see everything in Shinjuku. I missed out on the Godzilla head that's on top of a building there. So there's some stuff I gotta go back and see. It's hard to see everything. We went to Shibuya as well too. Shibuya is where there's that big crossing scramble thing. And, you know, in person, it's pretty small. It looks like this giant thing in pictures, but really it's like, that's it? I could jaywalk across the street right now, but it's still kind of cool to see because there's just a ton of people there. I missed out on a lot of Shibuya because when we went there, it was raining and we were all very tired. So I missed out on the Jordan Experience store and some of the other shops that I wanted to see. I wanted to see Miyahara Yasuhiro store. I didn't get to see that. I wanted to see the Chrome Hearts retail store as well too. Kids, let's go to the Chrome Hearts retail store. Not that I plan to buy anything, but just kind of walk in and walk out, I guess. And there's a lot of these kind of stores there, like Double Taps is appointment only, so you have to have planned the stuff out before, but there's nothing that probably fits me at Double Tap, so I wasn't exactly worried about it. You know, I was thinking about, you know, how I was talking about these Instagram reels and Instagram tourism, and that if I was going here as a content creator and brought a tripod, I could definitely make a ton of videos every single store. Here's what the Double Tap store is like, and here's how to make an appointment. And so if you're going, if you want to be a content creator, there you go. Free idea for you. But I did see the Kith Tokyo. It's in this mall called Miyashita Park, I think. I might be mispronouncing that. There's actually a lot of teens hanging out there, so maybe it is a cool part of Shibuya. There's a Kith Tokyo is in there, and Wonders in there, Hender Schemes in there. So we walked into a lot of those stores. There's also like Gucci and Louis Vuitton and stuff like that too. There's a Wrangler store in there, Wrangler, like Western wear clothing, but it's all kind of made in Japan or Korea or something. It was all actually really fire, but it's this whole thing where Japan fashion was inspired by Western fashion, which is now taking Western fashion and twisting it into a Japanese way, and Western fashion is now inspired by that remix. But really, my favorite area to go was probably Ginza. Ginza is kind of the birthplace of Japanese fashion, the birthplace of all that remixing. And just a sidebar history of men's fashion in Ginza. Basically in the 50s, after the war, there was this real switch from traditional wear to Western wear because there was like a few fires or something and people couldn't escape in a kimono. So then both men and women started embracing more Western wear. And then for men, younger men especially, they were almost always just wearing school uniforms. Like clothing stores only really sold clothing for kids and, you know, businessmen. And this is still 50s. This is still like U.S. occupation. And so there's always American soldiers there who had their own style from America. And they would, you know, they'd be listening to jazz and driving their own cars. And, you know, dressing like the Brooks Brother preppy Ivy League kind of style. And so that's where, you know, students and the 20-year-olds who are always just wearing uniforms started appropriating some of that Western culture and started wearing that kind of stuff. And so a lot of it is popularized by a guy named Kensuke Ishizu, who was like the godfather of this Ivy League style, who was like one of the first people to kind of bring this style in and try to make it in Japan and make it a thing. And they were basically just doing it based on random items that they could find from U.S. soldiers or from like magazine clippings, and trying to get Japanese tailors to make Brooks Brother type of prep outfits. So that guy, Ishizu, did, you know, worked really hard, you know, getting people out of this post-war kind of mindset and getting them to adopt fashion. And he, you know, he ultimately succeeded and people started wearing it. There's all these magazines, that one that he started, and there's another magazine. And in the magazines, they would often go to Ginza and, you know, find someone on the street and take a picture of him and put him in the magazine. And then that's kind of where this whole street snap kind of thing started. And then other kids wanted to do that. So eventually there was this whole thing where these kids were hanging out in Ginza wearing this preppy Brooks Brother type of clothing, wanting to be featured in a magazine. And then in the 60s or so, when the Olympics were coming in 64, I guess, is when, you know, in Japanese culture, you can't stand out. You gotta go with the flow. And so when the Olympics were coming in, they started cleaning this out. And so they stamped it all out. People couldn't hang out there and wearing their Ivy League prep style clothing that they kind of appropriated from Western wear. But from that is where like a thousand flowers bloomed, where, you know, fashion started becoming more of a thing after that. And that's where like Izzy Miyake and Yoji Yamamoto and all those other Japanese fashion designers that are much more known and popular, you know, emerged from or were inspired from. You know, maybe I'm missing a generation in there, but that is the very brief sidebar Cliff Notes version. This is all from a book I read a while back called A Meteora by W. David Marks. So if you're interested in the history of Japanese fashion and remixing American style, and then that Japanese remix style inspiring American style, it's all in that book. So Ginza is awesome. There's just so much history there. There's every big store is there. If you're a known big luxury company, you probably have a location there. Louis Vuitton. I went into the Grand Seiko store. There's a watch I really like, the Tentograph one. And you know, I was considering it for a bit. It's like 15,000 Canadian, which in Canada, it's probably like 18,000 Canadian plus tax. So I thought about it for a bit, but then I just couldn't pull the trigger. I'm like, maybe later is what I basically said. But then went into the Nike Ginza store, and that store is, you know, just a Nike store, but they had some cool things in there, some Nike Ginza specific t-shirts and hoodies. And one of the things I got was these Dubrays for Air Force Ones, a gold one and a silver. This is Nike Ginza. And then the guy was also nice enough to give me a Air Max Plus puzzle, because the whole Air Max activation was going on because of Air Max Day. But my favorite store in Ginza was Dover Street Market Ginza. It's 7 floors. It's got a Supreme in there. It's got a Louis Vuitton in there. It's got a Rick Owens in there. And, you know, any streetwear fashion brand that you could think of was in there. You go on the escalator, go up one level, do a little circle, go up the escalator, do a circle. It was just like people were nice in there. There was a lady wearing one of my favorite sneakers, the CDG Presto Tent. It's just the only sneaker I wear. And so it was cool seeing some Japanese lady wearing it as well, too. So, you know, I was thinking when I was in there, you know, I did that whole episode about the future of retail and moving online. And just walking in that store, it was like, this is how retail is, and this is how it's done right. And a really a great model for how a lot of stores would go. But the difference is that it's in Tokyo. So it's, you know, it's 7 floors, but each floor is not that big. It's not that huge. It doesn't feel like a big department store or anything. It feels comfortable and not too cozy. But whatever it is, I was super impressed with that place. It's awesome. I highly recommend you guys go see it. So a lot of other stores, like I said, I didn't go see. A lot of people recommended seeing the Capital stores or Biebs and stuff like that. You know, I kind of just skipped because I didn't think they would have my size. But, you know, I wasn't going to like drag my kids to go see a Capital store when there's nothing really going to be there for them there either. But it's, you know, it's part of the Japanese culture to embrace kind of Japanese stores and Japanese brands. So there's a lot of brands that you just don't see, like WeGo or Ships, or there's a popular brand called Beauty and Youth H. Like, I don't know, like another thing where it's like a random combination of letters and words, Beauty and Youth H. But it's the same thing. Like, what does the United Arrows mean? It doesn't mean anything, really. And there's also, like, this huge Tower Records there. And I went in there, and it just feels kind of cool and nostalgic. But at the same time, I was like, am I really going to buy a CD from Tower Records? I don't even have a CD player anymore. Well, at least I don't in my car. And, you know, I'm not going to carry around a vinyl for 2 weeks either. So I left it. But I did have a lot of fun at these stationery stores. There's one in Ginza, Itoya or something like that, I think it's called. And Loft is the other big one. We spent a lot of money at these stationery stores just buying cool mechanical pencils and stuff like that. The other thing I didn't do is vintage. I didn't go look at all these vintage shops. There's a lot in that Shibuya area. It was one of those things where it's like, eh, if I go again, that's what I will do. I will take a look at that. But because I just don't want to drag my kids to go look at vintage Louis Vuitton wallets or something. So that's it. Those are my thoughts. As you know, I guess I didn't have a real point about this other than if you're going, it might be helpful or useful for you. The overall thoughts of the country is it's a beautiful country. It's really awesome to see. I didn't even talk about the sightseeing stuff, but all that stuff was amazing. Seeing these temples on these hills, and we kind of missed Sakura season, the cherry blossoms, because it was still a little bit cold. And I think they all kind of bloomed the week after we were there. And that's kind of too bad, but it was still beautiful. And like, you just have to kind of understand Japanese culture to understand why the things are the way they are there. That you just gotta kind of blend in. You shouldn't try to stand out. And it's easy for me as a Canadian tourist to kind of understand that. So, and you did see a lot of tourists there. And, you know, you can go off and get lost and you won't see a tourist and you'll have a lot of fun. There'll be, like I said, awesome food everywhere. But tourists are going to come because things are cheap when you're in the country. And you kind of, as I alluded to, see it in the country as well, too. So it seems like people haven't gotten a raise there in a while. And so you can't raise prices if you're not giving the population more money. And the population is declining. And so there's a lot of older people working there. And they also don't do a lot of immigration. I did see a few immigrants working at like Subway or 7-Eleven. So they definitely have problems there, but you know, I wasn't there to solve those problems. I'm there to blow money. So I'm there to help, I guess, right? So it's a beautiful country to visit. I highly recommend it. But the one thing I'd highly, highly recommend you do is you go fuck yourself.